This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. Okay, then. Here we go. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday today, the 24th of February, 2022. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I mentioned the year there, which I never do, because time is extremely relevant to what is going on right now, to the invasion, to a resurgent Russia, to what sure looks like the end of the post-Cold War era, and to the uneven but general economic stability we have enjoyed the past 75 years. We did a show almost exactly 8 years ago today about the Russian takeover of Crimea and how it kind of felt back then like sort of a new Cold War was starting. And I told a story up at the top of the show that day about my time in the Navy, intercepting and keeping an eye on what were then Soviet bombers in the North Atlantic Ocean. This was 1988, 1989, nuclear bombers, big red Soviet star on the tail and everything. And I said 8 years ago, March of 2014, that we were a long way at that point from those Cold War days. And it turns out, we're really not. That broad but, again, uneven economic stability that collective security ensured the past 75 years is all kind of up in the air right now. What's going to happen is day to day. And today, it was a new round of sanctions by Europe, Japan, and the United States. President Biden made the announcement on the U.S. sanctions at the White House today. And to figure out exactly what's what, we've gotten Eddie Fishman back on the phone. He worked in the Obama State Department and is now a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council. Mr. Fishman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Kai. Good to be here.
So you watched the president, I'm sure. Big picture, what's your sense of the effectiveness of this round of sanctions?
Kai, this is the swift and severe consequences that Biden had warned about in recent weeks. I think there were some questions about whether the United States was actually prepared to really inflict significant damage on the Russian economy. What we're seeing in terms of the sanctions today are unprecedented in terms of sanctions against Russia. They include a real hammer blow to the Russian financial sector. Sberbank, the largest bank in Russia, is going to be cut off from all U.S. dollar transactions. And VTB, which is the second largest bank in Russia, is having all of its assets frozen and is completely blocked from the U.S. financial system. I think what is surprising, though, Kai, is that these sanctions went well beyond the financial sector and really cut across the commanding heights of the Russian economy, including mining, minerals, energy, transportation. Really, no sector of the Russian economy was left untouched by today's sanctions.
Did I miss oil and gas? Because that obviously is the big energy thing, but I don't recall the president talking about that specifically.
He did not talk about it much, but it was included in the package. Okay. Gazprom was actually cut off from debt and equity transactions in the United States. And I think that's a very significant action. It's demonstrating that the Biden administration is not, of course, going after oil sales directly or gas sales, but they are willing to target Russia's oil and gas companies directly.
What sanctions are supposed to do, really, is take the place of war, right? And we're clearly not sending troops into Ukraine, United States troops. The president has said that. So here's the follow-up sanctions question. In war, there are collateral damages, and oftentimes civilians and innocents are killed. To what effect do you think these sanctions will have on everyday Russians? Or does that not matter?
These sanctions will definitely impact everyday Russians, Kai, and I think that's part of the purpose. You know, the point of sanctions is to demonstrate that Putin's imperial delusions have a cost. If the Russian people can just go about their lives and have no consequences from Putin's unprecedented invasion, brazen invasion of Ukraine, I think that would be a problem. So there will be a substantial decline in living standards in Russia. But you mentioned things like humanitarian costs and humanitarian crisis. We are nowhere near that in Russia. So, you know, I think that, again, is a bit of a red herring. There is no way that these sanctions are going to create a humanitarian crisis in Russia. Russia is a relatively wealthy country. So they're not, you know, on the brink of that level of you know, pain and suffering amongst the population. But I do think these sanctions will decrease living standards, and I do think that's part of the purpose. The other thing, though, Kai, is that these sanctions are also very sharply targeted at the commanding heights of the economy. So I think even more than impacting everyday Russians, they're going to impact the Russian government, the Russian government's ability to generate hard currency, the Russian government ability to finance its military machine. And I think that's really the headline of sanctions today.
Okay. Last thing, and then I'll let you go. I had a question from a friend of mine today. And well, in fact, he asked all of Twitter, but I'm just going to steal it from him. And I'm going to ask you the question. He wanted to know, and I'm sure everybody else does too. We talk about sanctions all the time. We very rarely see them have lasting and profound effects. And so the question is there a way to do economic and diplomatic sanctions this time in a severe enough way that they match the horribleness of this invasion and what Putin is doing?
The short answer, Kai, unfortunately, is no. There are no sanctions that can be proportional to Russia's unprecedented and brazen invasion of Ukraine. It's just not possible, right? There's nothing economic that's proportional to the violence being inflicted upon innocent Ukrainians. What I will say, though, is that these sanctions undoubtedly will have significant long-term effects. And I think the bottom line is that so long as Putin continues to be president of Russia, Russia will not be able to benefit from the global economy. It will be a pariah politically and economically.
Eddie Fishman, he's a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Council, also ran the sanctions program against Russia back in the Obama administration. Mr. Fishman, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Kai.
Eddie Fishman and I talked about energy sanctions there for a little bit. Corporate sanctions, to be clear, not oil and gas sales sanctions, which if you are the West, capital W, which we all are, that's okay because we still buy a whole lot of Russian oil and gas. And yes, I know we say this a lot, but energy markets are global. So you disrupt those markets, not great things happen. Our man on energy, Andy Euler, explains what, if anything, can be done in the short term to mitigate the problem that is Russian fossil fuels.
About 40% of the European Union's natural gas comes from Russia. And Sophie Corbeau at Columbia University's Center on Global Energy Policy says the EU has known for a while that this is a problem, but hasn't done anything about it.
For the past 15 years, we have been talking about diminishing our reliance on Russian gas, and this has not happened.
She says a moment of crisis like this could lead to some movement. But Nico Safos at the Center for Strategic and International Studies says part of the problem is that there's an expectation that the West can just turn off the Russian energy pipe.
The reality is that it's really difficult to overhaul an energy system overnight. You just can't.
He says the questions that Western leaders need to be asking is how to make incremental changes right now.
Can you do that by asking industrial consumers to use less? You know, could you find additional supply from other sources in a way that doesn't undermine your long-term decarbonization plans?
And it's not just Europe relying on Russian natural resources. Energy Information Administration data shows that Russia supplied about 7% of U.S. crude oil imports at the end of last year. We occasionally buy Russian gas, too. Ellen R. Wald is a fellow at the Atlantic Council's Global Energy Center.
There are times in New England, because of pipeline bottlenecks, that it's actually been more efficient and cheaper for New England to import Russian LNG.
LNG, that's liquefied natural gas. Joshua Rhodes, an energy research associate at the University of Texas at Austin, says there are ways the West can minimize how much oil and gas it gets from Russia, but any disruption to the status quo is going to come with costs to consumers.
We're attuned to the oil markets, whether we knew it or not. And so any uncertainty or contraction in the supply of oil in the global markets will lead to a higher cost of gasoline at the pump. And, you know, that'll hit people's pocket.
The national average cost of a gallon of gas right now is $3.54. That's up almost a dollar from this time last year. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
We ought to be clear, it ain't just energy that's in play here. We talked commodities broadly the other day and how much of some of them Russia and Ukraine produce together. And sure enough, wheat futures today up 5.6%. Sunflower oil, of which those two countries produce 80, that is 80% of the world's export supply, up 3.4%. Aluminum up 1%. All right, not to get all macroeconomic on you here on a very geopolitical day, but there is something we need to talk about that, as of this morning, Ukraine time, is a bit more not out of the question. Higher inflation, yes, almost certainly, if only because of energy costs, but also slower economic growth because war. The word in question here is stagflation.
It has two parts. The first is the stag part, which is for stagnation, and that just suggests an economy that's going sideways, not growing.
Megan Green's a senior fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School, also global chief economist at Kroll Institute.
The inflation part is from inflation. So at the same time as growth is going nowhere, you have really high inflation.
You put them together, what do you got?
Stagflation is every central banker's worst nightmare.
Because
the tools that they have can only address one or the other. If they hike rates to address the inflation part of it, they will make the economy go into a recession, which they don't want to do.
No, they don't.
And if they don't hike rates or they cut rates in order to boost growth, then they also end up feeding more inflation.
And we know what that's like because those energy costs.
The Fed can't do much about higher energy costs, and they don't want to provide this double whammy to the U.S. consumer by hiking rates at the same time that people's money is being poured into gas and energy prices.
The thing is, higher oil and gas prices aren't just higher oil and gas prices.
When oil prices go up, then anything that requires energy to produce, so pretty much all goods, get more expensive as well.
You add all that up.
What we're seeing is that the U.S. economy is going to be much weaker this year than it was last year. So getting closer to sort of stagnation. We've had widespread inflation already that's been pretty broadly based.
Stagflation, maybe, because honestly, we just don't know.
There's just a ton of uncertainty about what's really going on with the economy, largely because of the pandemic and the fact that we've just never been through this before. So there were already huge questions.
Megan Green, she's at Harvard. Coming up,
the people who will pay for this are Russians, ordinary Russians.
Always rolls downhill, right? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, we call this the sad happy music because war? What war? Dow Industrial was up 92 points today, almost 0.3%, 33,223. NASDAQ added 436 points, 3.3%, 13,473. S&P 500 climbed 63 points, 1.5%, finished at 4,288. Got to tell you, though, the Dow was down like 850-something points at one point, so who knows? Cybersecurity stocks got a boost from Russia's invasion. Some analysts are warning they might step up cyber attacks on targets in the United States and our allies. Fortinet added 11.2%. CrowdStrike picked up more than 13%. So did Palo Alto Networks. Price of Brent crude is above $100 a barrel. 1 point today on the spot market. Automakers had a rough day. Stellantis down 6%. Europe, we don't usually do this, but here you go. The FTSE in the UK dropped 3.9%. The CAC 40 in Paris down 3.8%. The DAX in Germany dropped 4%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling shipping supplies or promoting productivity programs, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's a speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There is no real way to say what I'm about to say without it kind of clanging in the ear. So I'm just going to say it and hope you understand best intentions and context on this day. The reality is that war is expensive. It's unfathomably costly in lives and material and psychologically. But the unknowns of this and all wars for global trade and financial markets, corporations, and national economies, including this one, by the way, those unknowns are going to mean higher prices. And those higher prices, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains, generate economic risk, which is itself expensive.
For weeks, there have been warnings of a Russian invasion. But with bombs actually falling and tanks moving into Ukraine,
the mood is one of shock, disbelief.
Jacob Kierkegaard is in Brussels right now. He's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics.
This is the end of the pandemic and the beginning of the era of geopolitical risk at an entirely new level. And I think many of the supply chain issues that are still with us from the pandemic, they're going to be aggravated by this.
Global energy costs will rise, and so will food costs.
Both Russia and but also Ukraine are among the world's largest grain exporters. So I think we're going to see major disruptions of the world's food supply, more important than, say, that you and I have to wait, you know, an extra week to get our new flat screen TV, right?
Additional sanctions against Russian banks and companies will mess with global trade and financial relationships, says Carrie Steinbauer at international law firm Winston & Strawn.
We are seeing disruptions already in the maritime sector, in the shipping lanes coming out of the Black Sea, and then dealing some sovereign debt. The ripple effect will be throughout the financial sector. It could impact private equity, but also mutual funds.
U.S. financial markets have already faltered since the beginning of the year in the face of rising inflation and global tensions. Sam Stovall is chief investment strategist at CFRA Research.
From peak to trough, the market is off 12%. Many of the groups that had been doing very, very well, like semiconductors, home building, are now in their own bear markets.
To gauge market risk going forward, Stovall looks to an index called the VIX, which tracks volatility. It's running high right now, which means
the market expects volatility in the short term to be picking up. And what volatility means simply is that there's greater anxiety for investors.
Stovall says there's one potential positive economic effect of what's going on now. Central banks might not raise interest rates as aggressively to fight inflation, since that could slow the global economy right when a new European war is making the future murky and dangerous. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Speaking of central banks, as Mitchell was, ours meets 15-16 March. Mark your calendars. Regular listeners will know that I'm all about two things within the confines of this program, to be clear: history and context. And what we have with the events of the past 24 hours is an historical moment that is just screaming for some context. So we've gotten Dr. Christy Ironside on the phone. She's an assistant professor of Russian history at McGill University up in Montreal. Welcome to the program.
It's great to be here.
Let me get your thoughts, I guess, first of all, quickly on the news of the day. The Biden administration, the latest sanctions, and specifically knowing what you know about Russian history, how they might land over there.
Of course, it's all very worrying. And my immediate reaction to it as somebody who's studied the Soviet economy is that Russia, of course, has a very long history of being excluded from the world economy. For most of the 20th century, the ruble was non-convertible. You couldn't use it outside of the Soviet Union's borders. And that made them very creative in the ways that they conducted foreign trade, in the way that they developed foreign currency reserves, because they simply had to do this to be able to engage with the world economy. So I know that this is something that the Putin government has been doing steadily since 2014, hoarding foreign currency and reducing the reliance on Western imports. This is a much longer history in this context.
There was a moment sort of after the end of the Cold War, the collapse of the Soviet Union, they made some nods to a market economy. What was this Russian economy like when Vladimir Putin came to power 20 something years ago?
To put it really bluntly, it was a complete disaster. The 90s were an extremely economically difficult time for Russians. In other parts of the rest of the world, the U.S., the 90s were a relatively prosperous time. But in Russia, of course, they were coming off of, you know, aggressive shock therapy, reforms to the economy, trying to, you know, make the ruble convertible, of course, but also undo some of the subsidies and the price controls that had existed in the Soviet period, all of which really meant a much higher cost of living. It meant also a sort of decline in living standards, a quite precipitous decline in living standards in the 1990s for the average Russian.
His pitch, Putin's, was back when he first came to power, was basically economic stability, right? You look at all that you just explained to us, and he said, I can take care of that. I got it.
Yeah, this is one of the things that he did when he came to power. He clawed back some of the wealth that had been accumulated by the oligarchs. He also created the stabilization fund, which was a massive fund of money that allows the Russian government to tide itself over, especially to tide over things like the welfare state when there are shocks to oil prices, because, of course, oil revenue is still one of the most important sources of income for the Russian government.
Okay, so how do you square the promises that Putin made with his actions now, which, and look, we're going to have to wait to see how this plays out. As the president said today, it's going to take a while. But clearly it will lead to Russia being more economically isolated and having
a harder time of it?
This is the big question. At the end of the day, the people who will pay for this are Russians, ordinary Russians, who are going to see a higher cost of living, who are going to see their opportunities for travel, for leaving the country restricted. This is going to be really tough for them. And this is coming, of course, after a period in which the economy has already been very tough for them since 2014 and during the pandemic.
We'll note here that you are an historian of the Russian economy. You're not an economist. So I'm going to ask you the anecdotal question and not the analytical question. You studied over there, right? You must have at certain points in your career.
I did. I spent a lot of time in Russia in the 2010s for dissertation research. And then I was there for a year after I finished my PhD. I had a postdoc there in 2014.
Gotcha. Were you getting paid in rubles?
I was getting paid in rubles.
Okay. So you know where I'm going now, right? In 2014, the ruble fell off the table. It's down hard today. What does that mean for, you know, the grandmother going out to buy a loaf of bread?
It means that prices are going to go up, and they're going to be the ones who shoulder the sort of daily burden of this.
So, one last thing, and then I'll let you go, Professor. The Russians make no secret of the fact that they like to be considered a hardy people. They've dealt with trauma and difficulty for literally generations, right? Do they endure this? What do you think it takes to make them say, okay, we don't want you anymore, President Putin?
I honestly have no idea. I can tell you, as to your first question, they have definitely endured these kinds of crises before. They have made do with less. They have grown their own food. They have, you know, eaten the Russian domestically produced mozzarella that tastes nothing like the EU imported stuff. It has happened before, seriously. So I think that, you know, there is a great capacity to deal with this. But of course, what this does in terms of confidence in the economy, confidence in the leadership, I don't know.
Dr. Christy Ironside, she's a professor of history up at McGill University in Montreal. Professor, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, just because once I got the history thing going, you knew I wasn't going to let it go. Right. Anyway, this one comes with a tip of the hat to Victoria Guida over at Politico. The minutes of a meeting of the Federal Reserve on October 23rd, 1962. Why does that matter? It matters because it was smack in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Alfred Hayes, then the vice chair of the Fed, as the world was about as close to nuclear war as it's gotten, said, and here's a quote, "We must, I believe, simply wait and see, preserving maximum flexibility to reduce or increase the existing degree of monetary ease in the light of future developments." I like to think that that's kind of what Jay Powell is thinking right now, too. All right, we got to go. But here is your moment of economic context on a day when a whole lot of things changed. Actually, I'm going to timestamp some prices here. We can come back and check them later. Natural gas at the New York Mercantile Exchange, down almost 1.2%. And gas for cars. Euler talked about this. AAA says today's national average, $3.54 a gallon. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, and Amanda Peacher are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.